Maui Nui is on a mission to help balance axis deer populations for the good of our environment, communities, and food systems on the island of Maui. They've shared over 126,000 pounds of nutrient-dense protein with the Maui community. Secure your spot now. Become a snack subscriber and join in helping to build more resilient food and ecosystems on Maui. Visit MauiNuiVenison.com. That's MauiNuiVenison.com. And use promo code BEAR for 20% off your first order.
After 3 years of work, our follow-up to the Meat Eater Fish and Game Cookbook is here. It's the Meat Eater Outdoor Cookbook, wild game recipes for the grill, smoker, campfire, and camp stove. Here is your book for everything that's best cooked or eaten outside, from grilling to open fire cooking to Dutch ovens to smokers to barbecue to backpacking meals to how to pull off the perfect fish fry. With pit stops along the way for lessons about ice age cooking methods and the best 5 ways to construct a cooking fire you can be proud of. And of course, we're focusing on wild game and fish here with over 100 recipes, including stuffed venison burgers 3 ways, wild duck with aji verde sauce, a jerky made with cola, a gin and tonic made with fire charred lemons, and grilled frog legs made with a sticky sweet sauce. This ain't your normal cookbook, so be prepared to be surprised. Get your copy now. For more info, visit themeateater.com or buy it wherever books are sold.
My name is Clay Newcomb, and this is a production of the Bear Grease Podcast called the Bear Grease Render, where we render down, dive deeper, and look behind the scenes of the actual Bear Grease Podcast. Presented by FHF Gear, American-made, purpose-built hunting and fishing gear that's designed to be as rugged as the places we explore.
We got it. We got it.
Just play in the Dutch oven.
I wandered so aimless in a life filled with sin. I wouldn't let my dear Savior in. Then Jesus came out like a stranger in the night. Praise the Lord, I saw the light. I saw the light. I saw the light. No more darkness, no more night. Now I'm so happy, no sorrow inside. Praise the Lord, I saw the light. That's right. Sing with me. Just like a blind man, I wandered along. Worries and fears I claim for my own. Then like a blind man that God gave back his sight. Praise the Lord, I saw the light. I saw the light, I saw the light. No more darkness, no more night. Now I'm so happy, no sorrow inside. Praise the Lord, I saw the light.
Excellent.
Finally nailed it. Nailed it.
Josh Spillmaker on
Josh
the
Josh Spillmaker on the Lodge Cast Iron Dutch Oven. Welcome to the Bear Grease Render. Great to have everyone here on the Bear Grease Render. We've got a great lineup for you today. To my left, I have Misty Newcomb.
Hello.
Who's accompanying me on the banjo. To Misty's left, we have Brent Reeves. Brent, great to see you.
You put too much salt in the gravy.
I don't know if that's possible.
Yeah, we just made a big, huge, like 12-man
football team
skillet size. We figured we could have fed 12 men an average helping of gravy,
which is about a quart.
Brent says too much salt. I wasn't going to say this, but last time Brent cooked me gravy, I didn't think it had enough salt.
I have to say, I saw that video.
Yeah,
and I don't remember you putting salt in it in the video
because he didn't.
Ooh, Brent.
Well, you.
Wow.
You basically made paper mache.
No, everybody puts the right amount of salt, their own salt, because you can always put
salt
I'm 100%
in.
With Brent on this.
But you can't take it out.
100%. Because Clay Newcomb likes an enormous amount of salt. And for me, too. It's like a little bit too much.
See, my so Alexis with, was here.
Now, I'm
okay,
with Brent.
Too much salt. Like, if you eat too much salt, what are the symptoms of that? Like,
high blood pressure. So they say.
Thirsty?
I have great blood pressure.
Clay also has had multiple nights in the last year where he couldn't sleep because he had consumed so much salt.
Well, how do you? That is, you don't
that
know
would
that.
Be a slight
we need
exaggeration.
To hear more about this.
Okay.
Twice. Oh, I'll tell you.
So, how many
twice
times did I say
I ate salt
twice
pork.
This year?
Twice? No, not this year. It hadn't even happened this year. Twice in the last 3 years, I've eaten salt pork.
Where do you? Where does one procure salt pork?
At the right grocery store.
Petty Jean Meats.
Thank
right,
you very
okay,
much.
Okay.
That's exactly
salt
right.
pork is incredible stuff. It is incredible stuff. But man, it will send you through the roof.
To the better than ER. Coffee. But
I don't know. For real, I couldn't sleep. I told Brent. I called Brent after I ate salt pork one time.
Like your heart
and I said. I said, I woke up 3 times last night and drank out of the bathroom faucet.
He literally did.
You know you're thirsty when you go in the bathroom. And yeah. So anyway, but
don't
I don't eat that much salt that often. So
it was good.
Brent Reeves, I respect your gravy stuff. I'm and with Josh, so I like a little salt.
I like my salt cooked
so,
into the
okay. Okay. Alexis was here, and she doesn't put salt in anything. She's from Texas, and she's crazy. But that's just the way it is. And if mama don't want salt in there, daddy don't put it in.
Now, that's not a Texas thing. That's like a...
That's an Alexis thing.
That's like a girl from Tyler, Texas. That's never put her foot in the grass before.
That's her.
Yeah.
That's my girl.
Yeah. Great lady.
A really great person.
She is.
Not much of a tomato farmer or salt eater.
No, she'll kill him.
To Brent's left, Isaac Neal. Assistant producer of Bear Grease.
It's big.
Wow.
Assistant to the.
Yeah, we always introduce him like that. I mean, he is.
Yeah, I mean,
me
that's
and Isaac
just
work
a, big
a lot together on Bear Grease every
yeah.
day.
I've been sowing the seeds of getting a promotion by promoting you.
How's that going to work?
I want you to be bumped up to executive producer so then I can be the producer.
That's a good idea.
Rising tide floats all ships.
We pretty much make up our own titles around here so we can do what we want.
He needs to really apply himself.
Yeah, I'm hoping in the next 5 years I can get promoted to producer.
I think you're there.
So our really special guest this week, though, to the left of Isaac, is my brother, Zach Newcomb.
Hey, everybody.
Wow.
So nice
Zach,
to be here.
Yeah, y'all didn't know I had a brother, did you, until the last podcast.
You have a brother?
Well,
Zach,
I have a brother?
I've actually got two.
Is this your first time on the Bear Grease podcast?
And the render.
Yeah. Yes.
Because I think that you've got some bones to pick with Clay.
Do I? I probably have many bones
well,
to pick. You're going to have to be more specific.
Yeah. You got mad at me about something.
You about one of the, and you said.
Oh,
what did I get mad at?
Because Clay said he's the only one of the Newcomb brothers who made it through the Gary. Let me just pour some salt in the wound.
Speaking of salt.
Exactly.
We may have to have a talk after this. And you're the only
actually,
one here that doesn't know it.
Actually, Clay has multiple talks after the podcast. You can have him first, Misty. I'll take him next.
No, yeah. I said I was the only Newcomb boy who graduated from the Gary Newcomb School of Hunting Hard Knocks.
And that wasn't the Bear Grease, though. That was the
Well, and then I remember you
podcast.
Said, Clay, you said that as if me and Tyler failed. And you said me and Tyler never were in the school.
We never wanted to enroll.
Yeah. I have some memory.
But Zach was a feature guest on this last Wetzel Deathwind podcast. So
what's
Zach,
it like? What's it like to be a featured guest on the Bear Grease podcast?
You
I've
know,
always wondered.
Josh wouldn't know.
Josh still
just something, Josh. One of these days, maybe. One of these days.
Yeah,
so, Zach, what are your credentials inside the mental health field?
So, I'm a clinical social worker. I've been, and right now I'm in private practice. So, I have my own office in Northwest Arkansas where I, do individual therapy, see people with trauma and depression, anxiety, see multiple ages.
How long have you been doing that?
I've been doing that since 20 years, probably.
20 years.
Well, not in private practice. I was a clinical director for a bit. I've worked at some group homes. And then, in private practice. Done a lot of in-home work with families.
Have you
done
ever
a lot
diagnosed
with the Department
a
of Human
frontiersman
Services.
From the middle ground?
A frontiersman from the middle ground?
Yeah. What they call the middle ground.
I have not.
Okay.
Good. That was a trick question.
I've got a... Oh, yeah, because you can't diagnose someone who's not in person. Yeah. I have a more pressing question.
Okay.
What if a frontiersman from the middle ground walked into his office today, what would they be diagnosed with?
It would be fair game.
Yeah, it'd be fair game.
I'm not saying they time traveled. I'm just saying dude shows up wearing buckskins, scalps on his belt.
I mean,
what do you start talking to that guy about?
I'm going to first look at the condition of the skin, thinking maybe zombie at first.
Yeah.
Right? I want to rule that out. And then from there, it's on. I don't know. We're going to do lots of scans and tests.
Yeah.
So we're going to come back to you, Zach. So to Zach's left, to finalize introductions, Josh Landbridge, Spillmaker. Great to see you, Josh.
Fly fisherman, deck builder, name
Josh
it.
Josh has been helping me build a deck.
It's true.
Hey, so I've been doing a fair bit of construction as of late, building a deck, and we're getting ready for a few things. And I told a story earlier today to Brent and Isaac that I had not remembered in a long time. It had almost been erased from my memory. When I first started a landscape company, circa 2005, something like that, I had a 16-foot trailer. I had a truck, like a 3/4-ton short cab Chevrolet truck. And I had a Kubota tractor, small Kubota tractor. Well, the area I was working in, Fayetteville, Arkansas area, is really hilly. And there's a lot of people building on these pretty steep slopes and different things. Well, this is something that you learn when you're around heavy equipment. You learn it real quick. But I had never worked with anybody else, so no one had taught me this, which I proceeded to teach everyone after me this. So I backed my trailer down their driveway because when you got down there, it was like real tight and you couldn't turn around. There was this little section of concrete and it was like gravel and then concrete. And I backed my trailer down in there to unload all the stuff and whatnot. Well, it came time to leave, finish the job, and I'm pulling the tractor into the trailer. And my truck is on the gravel. My trailer is on the concrete. And my truck is like pointed uphill pretty severely. 12 feet behind the tailgate of my trailer is a very steep drop off that just goes down the mountain. Trees, and it was kind of like built up red dirt where they built a concrete pad and then it just dove off down the mountain. Well, I go down there and square up the tractor to the tailgate of the trailer and start driving onto the trailer. Well, I didn't have any little legs on the back of my trailer, so when the weight of the tractor was on the back of the trailer, the hitch of the trailer lifts and pulls the weight. You know, the ball is attached to the trailer, so it lifts the back tires of the truck essentially off the ground almost. And I'm like halfway on the trailer. As soon as my wheels get onto the tailgate, the truck and trailer just starts coming back, just sliding down the hill. The gravel's popping, and the truck, trailer, tractor and me are all gaining speed going down the hill.
And bobsled to the ER.
I was petrified. I was by myself there. I jumped off the trailer onto the ground. The trailer and truck are still sliding. I run and jump into the moving truck and jam the brakes, which doesn't do any good because all the weight's still, like, there's no weight on the back of the truck. The weight of the tractor's pulling me down. And finally, after just cramming on the brakes, it skids. And basically, the trailer gets hung up, hanging out over the edge. And my tractor like dangling over, like this big drop-off. And I can't move. Like I put it in park. And then I start to take my foot off the brake. And it starts going again. And so I had a cell phone. I was in cell range. And so I call a wrecker. And I say, man, if I get out of my truck or take my foot off the brake, I'm going over a ledge. How quick can you get here? And they were like, well, we can be there in probably about 30 minutes.
Don't get in a hurry.
I know. They're always so like calm and cool.
And I was like, well, I'll be right here. I won't be going anywhere. And I sat in my truck until the wrecker came, and I stuck my head out the window and was like, I ain't getting out of this truck. I'm not taking my foot off this brake. Just hook me up and get me out of here. And so he did. He was able to.
Well, how long did it take him?
You know, I really don't even remember. It was a non-dramatic rescue once he got there. he just was pretty quickly able to hook on and
those
just
are the best kind of rescues.
So, all that to say.
What?
Yeah, what's the point of the story?
Story was that.
If Wetzel would have been there.
This was just an exciting story that came up in my memory bank today with Brent and Isaac. Isaac. It was totally relevant, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm
what
right
a
there
yes
with you.
Man. He
just wants a promotion.
Along, I do have something I want to show you guys. You may have seen this on Instagram. Isaac and I were traveling through, where were we, Isaac?
We were in Illinois.
We were in Illinois, and we walk into a Native American gift shop, and it was no ordinary Native American gift shop. It was a, I mean, huge log cabin building, very nice.
It's a land of wonder.
Multiple stories.
Yeah.
I mean, like, incredible diversity of products.
Yeah.
Authentic stuff, buffalo hides, animal hides, stone points, shirts, art.
$6 sunglasses.
I bought a nice pair of $6 sunglasses. Many. And then I saw this on the back wall. And if that is not a Black Panther, I mean, I would say real Black Panthers, probably their heads aren't this big.
I wish they were.
And note that I said real Black Panthers.
Because there is such a thing.
They might be.
But that is a, I mean, that's
how
art.
Much you give for that bad boy?
Probably more than it was worth, but I didn't care. I told Isaac, I said, I don't care what it costs.
I'm thanks, Meat Eater.
Steal it twice the price.
Thanks, Meat Eater.
I haven't figured out where to put it yet, though.
I'm curious to know what made it a Native American gift shop.
That is how they build themselves. There were billboards.
That I mean, that's what, so.
Yes.
That's what it was called. I mean, like Native American gift shop, next exit, turn right.
Okay.
And they also did wholesale, yeah.
I did like a bat turn on the interstate.
Yeah.
And it was,
well, it was worth it.
The lady was exceptionally nice.
Oh, incredible.
When I walked up there with this, I figured she would be like, who are you?
Yeah.
Who would buy this?
And she acted like they sell these like every other person that walks in there.
Yeah. She's got three in her home.
Nuh-uh.
I mean, it's a nice looking
home. No, I don't know. That was the vibe that you got from her. Yeah.
That is a beautiful cat. Yeah.
I'm telling you what,
she was just like, oh, it's going to look so nice.
Did she for real say that?
Oh, she was excited that we bought this. And she wanted to sell me another one.
I'm sure was excited. Have you probably been there for like 10 years? She's like, it's a miracle.
Oh, man.
They probably have a bet going back in the break room.
I'm just kind of going through a little checklist. Okay, I had, I don't make it a point to read too many of the iTunes reviews.
Okay.
I do, because there's some really good ones.
I did have a gentleman who brought into question me saying that the Ouachita Mountains were the only mountains between the Appalachians and the Rockies that run east and west. And I hope this guy's listening, and I hope he doesn't think I'm being rude to him, but he had a little bit of a chip on his shoulder when he was like, Clay, you might want to do some fact checking.
He's a little sassy.
He was a little sassy.
There was sass.
There was some sass in it.
There was sass.
And I don't want to make this a thing where, because I'm the guy with the microphone,
sure,
I make the guy without the microphone look stupid.
Right.
But that's going to be hard to do here.
He's just wrong.
There's so many more diplomatic ways to do that.
He challenged me on this thing.
The moral of the story is don't challenge the man with
the guy with the microphone.
Well, iTunes reviews.
That's a general rule of life.
I appreciated his desire for engagement.
He's clearly invested in the Bear Grease
premise
universe
of what was said.
Metaverse.
Because he said that the Ozarks ran east and west too, which, granted, there are ridges and mountains in the Ozarks that do run east and west, but that does not make them a mountain range that runs east and west. The Ozarks are completely jumbled. The Ozarks were formed by erosion, so there was a plateau. I mean, I go through this like, this podcast ought to be called How the Orogeny of the Ozark and Ouachita Mountains, because I go through it about every other podcast.
Also at our dinner table.
When the South American continent bumped into the North American continent, there was a bulge. The Ozark Plateau bulged. And that was in the north, it bulged, and that plateau eroded randomly. And so there's ridges that run east and west, north and south, southwest, northwest, any direction you want.
Say it with me, Josh. Boring.
Soapbox much?
Okay, and the Ouachitas were formed, they were closer to the impact, and they actually buckled. And the Ouachita Mountains look like the furrows of a plowman's field. That long east-west ridge.
What's the elevation that requires that means it's a mountain?
I do not believe there is an actual elevation that makes something a mountain.
I think
yeah, what, aren't you an environmental soil science major?
Zach, don't feed that.
Shouldn't you be able to tell us this?
No, I don't think there's anything that makes it a mountain.
Are
you kidding?
Maybe. I could be wrong.
What brought this up is we were looking at a hydrological map of Arkansas earlier today, and it's just so clear that the Ouachitas run east and west. It's just like somebody got bored and drew lines across the map there.
Yeah.
That is not what the Ozarks looks like.
Yeah.
As a proud Ozarker, born and bred.
Yeah, yeah.
Love the Ozarks. Not a...
Yeah, so I don't want to make a big deal about it. Misty has something.
Most geologists classify a mountain as a landform that rises at least 1,000 feet, a.k.a. 300 meters, or above its surrounding areas.
Oh, there you go.
There you go.
So, you know, the highest peaks in Arkansas are about 3,000 feet.
Okay.
The Appalachians are much bigger. Did you know that the highest peak in east of the Mississippi is in southern Appalachia somewhere, and I think it's just under 7,000 feet. That's a high mountain.
Mm, yeah, that is.
I believe it's, I don't want to say, I'll get more emails.
You know, I was pretty...
And you'll be wrong that time.
I would be wrong. Yeah. There's a mountain. I think it's called Mount Mitchell.
It was pretty cool. You know, we were in Maui a couple weeks ago.
Check what's the biggest mountain in the Appalachian mountain range.
We're in Maui a couple weeks ago, and it's weird to sit on the beach, and then we went up to Haleakala, if I'm saying that right. Well, National Park.
In Spanish.
Yeah. And it's 10,025 feet.
Wow.
You go from the beach to 10,025 feet.
Hey, here's another thing to fact check. I think that might be the tallest mountain in the world from its base.
Oh, really?
Which is far below the ocean.
Yeah.
As opposed to Mount Everest, which is the tallest mountain from sea level.
Gotcha. That would make sense.
I mean, it's impressive.
What's the biggest mountain in the Appalachians?
Mount Mitchell.
What
score?
Are you saying tallest mountain from base in North America?
No.
Just ever?
In the world.
I'm putting it out there.
All good right. job. Just be bold.
Yeah, absolutely.
Say the name, Josh.
Haleakala.
Mauna Kea.
Okay, that is in Hawaii.
Mauna Kea?
That's a different volcano.
I knew it was a Hawaiian mountain because I went the first time I read that, I thought, no.
and
he was just like, no.
Turns out I was wrong.
Isaac has a toddler, y'all. So,
Isaac is a toddler.
This podcast, Lewis Wetzel, The Death Wind. What did you think of it? General thoughts.
He's a mean rascal.
Yeah,
he was mean.
He didn't strike me as the most psychologically healthy person.
Yeah,
there's a lot. You know, I hate to oversimplify this, but I was listening to it again on the way up here, and there was a lot in there. The guy that y'all talked to up in Ohio or Illinois,
Chip.
Yeah, and he was talking about how people thought, how Native Americans thought of Europeans and how the Europeans thought of the Native Americans as not being worthy, not being humans, you know, that each had that opinion. And the only thing I can relate that to is growing up, my grandmother had a pecan tree in the backyard, and I got a nickel for every blue jay that I could shoot out of that pecan tree. If I shot a red bird, she would have beat me to half to death. But blue jays were fair game because they knocked the pecans out of the tree before they got ripe, and they would ruin. Mm-hmm. To this day, I sit in my backyard, and I got bird feeders out there, and we sit out on the patio in the evenings when it's not so hot, and we watch the birds. And I love seeing red birds up there, but to this day, a blue jay flies up in my backyard, and I think, if I had a BB gun right now, somebody would owe me a nickel. It was just ingrained in me from a small child that blue jays were bad.
Yeah.
But
there's really nothing that's going to change that.
No, they're beautiful. But my first thought when I see them is, he's got to die.
Yeah.
That's what I think. You know, I don't follow through with it.
This is getting dark quick.
Pretty dark.
But I mean, you see the correlation.
Yeah, I do. That's a great correlation.
That was the only thing.
Because it's not really fair. It's why is that bird any different than that bird?
Exactly.
I'd like to point out, and we talked a little bit about this on the phone the other day, but this idea that like there was some cognitive dissonance in people. Like, I think that they were aware that they were making up excuses to dehumanize these people to justify their actions. A couple examples are there were missionaries to the Native Americans at that point in time. Like, if they're not people, then why are we trying to evangelize to them? And secondly, if there is a context in which killing a Native American is wrong, i.e. the time that he got tried for murder, then you're kind of aware of the humanity of these people anyway.
Yeah.
And so I think that's part of what makes this story stand out and carry through to be like, man, even in a time when people were like doing something that on one level they knew was wrong. I mean, really effectively what was happening was like, I know it's wrong to kill other human beings, but I really want this land and they're standing in the way. That like full stop. But like a lot of people did a lot of justifying in the middle of it, which is not to assuage all the actions that Native Americans took in retaliation. But it is to say that, like, they were aware of the humanity. It was just something that they had convinced themselves of. In a certain context, this is okay. This is appropriate. Fear-based. You went too far. Yeah.
And what happened here in North America has not been uncommon to planet Earth at all.
Oh, no.
I mean, it's still happening to this day in some places. And it's, it's the problem of humanity.
I could just imagine the justification that was given for, you know, and I think people had to have turned a blind eye to what he was doing. Just, you know, that's just him. Because there were people who were not that way. For instance, Daniel Boone. You mentioned Daniel Boone,
yeah,
who had a completely different standard in the way that he interacted with people. But man, there's people out there. You run into it, and Zach probably sees it as much as anybody. But just that there's a thing inside of them that drives them to. It's almost an insanity to do this thing no matter what the cost. And he just had this mindset to.
Well, this
I don't
is
even
what,
know if it was like it's not that he wanted to murder. He wanted to eradicate Indians, you know.
See,
whatever
he,
the cost.
Wetzel, he defined the perimeter of what was acceptable to white culture during that time. I mean, just American culture during that time, because some people thought he was over the line, other people didn't. And in an hour long podcast, I really didn't have time to even tell the whole story. He became a somewhat of an anti-government hero to the people on the frontier who were having trouble with Native Americans, and the government would come in and try to stop them and wouldn't be able to, and they would be like, well, if Louis Wetzel was here, he could stop them. And he was actually more efficient as a guerrilla warfare guy than even the government. And so he all of a sudden is brought to this position of even more esteem inside these communities, you know. And I can't get past, and again, this is not, I said it on the podcast, and this is not a justification. Like I said, I'm not trying to justify. I'm just trying to make sense of how stuff like this could happen. And man, if you lived on the frontier, these Indian hunters, these Indian scouts would be people that the vast majority of culture deeply respected. And I want to say something else too, is that there's this idea that you know, white Europeans came and took the land from these Native Americans. There were generations when Europeans first got here where literally they've left their home in Europe, came here, and then would have tried to take land from Native Americans to live. And there, you know, there was a time when Native Americans were saying, yeah, come on over here. But then there are people that are born here very quickly. And they wake up and they're like, well, we got to have a place to live. And so they start trying to acquire lands and whatnot. And very quickly you get people who are born here, who are native people to this continent. Now their parents weren't, their grandparents weren't. And it kind of takes, to me, it's different than just like somebody coming and trying to take someone's land. And even the Native American chiefs told Tecumseh that when Tecumseh tried to build this Pan-Indian Federation. Basically, Tecumseh went to all the tribes and tried to say, hey, we can push all the white people back to Europe. That's the simple version of Tecumseh's life. And many of the Native American leaders said, where are they going to go? These aren't the people that came here. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
A little bit?
I get what you're saying. I think this gets at another thing that we talked about on the phone, and this is like a regret that I have about this episode, is until listening to it, I didn't even think. You had tasked me with finding somebody to interview on this, and when I was listening to it, I was like, there is not a native voice present in this, and this is a story that is wholly dependent on a native voice. Not wholly dependent.
Yeah, yeah.
Half of the story is about him killing Native Americans, right? And so, like, I would just love to hear the other perspective on that, because for me, very easy to empathize with what you just said. And then I go, like, what's the other side of the story, right? Because there is in a conflict two sides of the story, and the victor often gets to write the history.
Yeah, and that's true.
And beyond that, I think that we are guilty of like a little bit of essentialization in terms of humanity when we're trying to tell stories. And so it's like there was so much going on where no one is a monolith. There were people who were pretty comfortable with this, and then there was other dynamics going on, like the idea where Eastern tribes had already been pushed west. And so it's not like all Native American tribes were hunky-dory and pushing towards one goal. Like, they were fighting for resources and space within that and fighting with this thing that was external, white colonizers. And I don't know. It's just like, I don't know that there is an answer. I don't know if you can sum it up.
And there's no possible way that Native Americans didn't, I mean, it was essentially genocide. I mean, like all the terrible descriptors that we know.
Which,
and I guess my point in seeing the way people handled guys like Wetzel is that it was a little bit more like a frog in boiling water. Mm. Like this thing took place over the course of really 500 years.
Yeah.
From the time the first white Europeans went inland into what's now the United States and spread smallpox and you know, as much as 80-90% of Native Americans died from disease, to all the way up to Wetzel, which is pretty late history. I mean, like Wetzel died in 1808. Yeah. Honestly, that's like not
closer
that long
to us
ago.
Than boots on the ground for the first time for white European settlers.
Exactly. So it was just this long period, and it was a war. Like Zach said, like Ranella said, this was a war zone. Zach, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed the podcast, Clay. Good job.
Right on.
You know what? I had never heard Wetzel's story before. Obviously, you and I had some conversations before.
So yeah, you didn't listen to the podcast before. Just heard me tell you stuff.
Yeah, you and I talked for 10 minutes. You know, before that podcast, and you shot me that song.
Yeah, listen to the very ballad of Lewis Wetzel.
Yeah, very informative ballad of Lewis Wetzel.
For making a diagnosis.
Can you determine whether or not he's a psychopath by this ballad?
Based on this ballad. You know, I mean, I agree with what Isaac said in that, I mean, there's not really a good answer there, right? I mean, this was an awful situation. And to me, what I see is that, like, when I look at this, it's like, I mean, you throw, it's almost like cooking a good stew, Misty, right? You know, you throw a bunch of ingredients in, and this is what you get, right? I mean, if you've got this war zone happening, you've got, you know, probably, I mean, a lot of unethical stuff happening across the board, right? You've got these people on the border. You've got this one guy with this crazy trauma. And when you throw humans into certain environments and they've got certain genetic tendencies, things pop up, right? And Wetzel is one of those dynamics that pops up. And you could probably find, I mean, you mentioned too, you can go back all across history. You can go to Nazi Germany. You can go to genocides and all over the place. There's stuff happening now that you could find. My guess is you could find a very similar story to Wetzel's for that context, right?
Yeah.
You can find somebody who, you know, extreme trauma, really laid against a certain population or people or people group, right?
Yeah.
And if they've got certain tendencies, then that's what it's going to create, right? And so, you know, it's a sad story. I totally agree. I mean, I had the same thought Isaac did about it would have been interesting to have a Native American voice in there.
I apologize.
I mean, especially if you could have found somebody who knew Wetzel's story.
Yeah.
Right.
And honestly, we had a hard time finding
anybody that knew the story.
Because Wetzel was such a periphery character. Like he wasn't a Boone that really influenced American identity. Yeah. He wasn't a Davy Crockett. He wasn't a war hero. He was just, I mean, he was known literally just for what we told about, like killing Indians. So there's not many people that we couldn't find an academic expert that said, raise my hand. I am the expert on this guy. Yeah. It was just all these little hodgepodge stories from different people. And then we found Chip Gross.
Chip's our guy.
What a guy.
Incredible. Yeah.
So those are my general, I mean, it was an awful story. I didn't know, even here, when we spoke, I didn't know he had a brother. And so, I guess I knew but I didn't know his brother had the aggressive tendencies
All his brothers were heavily involved in just pretty rough stuff with Native American.
And so it's just a rough story, and it just shows, I mean, what people can become in the right environment, right? And in the right, I mean, you know, there's a little bit of genetics involved, and there's, the wrong environment. But, you know, how the environment shape us and form us and change us. And I'm not saying that, I mean, even in the podcast, I think one of the guys that was interviewed, it's not an excuse necessarily, right?
Sure.
I mean, like Wetzel had choices.
Right.
He had choices. He could have been different. But it's an awful story. I mean, it's one that you go back and, I mean, I think you mentioned in the podcast too, where's the redemption in this? And it's a little bit tough to find, other than it makes me thankful for where I'm at.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it makes me thankful for the context and where I'm at and the culture that we live in. Because even now in 2022, there are places that are more similar to that environment that Wetzel was in than the environment that we live in.
Yeah.
Those are my musings on it.
Montana Knife Company was founded by Josh Smith, one of the world's most experienced master bladesmiths. He's been making knives for 30 years, made in the USA and manufactured locally in Montana. The knives come with a multi-generational warranty and free sharpening. Designed, tested, and built by hunters, MKC is a hunting knife company first and foremost. They have the sharpest knives out of the box and the easiest knives to sharpen. And that is the dadgum truth. You better be careful with them when you get them. They are sharp. MKC is a fast-growing company. They just hired their 55th employee and are looking to hire about 50 more in the next year or so. I've carried a lot of these Montana knives, and the one that I like the most is their Speed Goat, which is a lightweight hunting knife, just the right size. MKC knives sell out within minutes of being released. So head over to MontanaKnifeCompany.com. They have new knives for sale every Thursday at 7 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. So check their website and sign up for their text and email alerts. That is the best way to find out when they have knives available. Use code BEARGREASE10 for 10% off your first order. Montana Knife Company, working knives for working people. The old timers say that the turkeys start gobbling when the leaves are as big as squirrels' ears and the red buds start popping. And we're about there. And we are there in the South. The Onyx Hunt App is one of my most valuable tools in the spring woods. With tools like coniferous versus deciduous tree distribution layer, you can save time by locating edges or transition areas of mixing habitats from home. Find an area like this with water in close proximity, and more than likely, there will be a gobbler turkey nearby. Knowing the exact boundaries of private ground ensures I stay on the right side of the fence, but can easily find public ground to go see if I can't strike a gobbler. If you do get one to sound off, using compass mode and waypoints will help you pinpoint his exact location, allowing you to move in and make the perfect setup to bring him right into your lap. Download the Onyx Hunt app today. You'll be glad you did. Onyx has a special offer for you. Use code BEARGREASE to receive 20% off your membership at onyxmaps.com/hunt this spring. We've all seen plenty of gadgets and fads come and go, but here's one product that stood the test of time, Seafoam Motor Treatment. Lots of hunters and anglers know that Seafoam helps engines run better and last longer. It's really simple. When you pour it in your gas tank, Seafoam cleans harmful fuel deposits that cause engine problems. I'm talking common stuff like hard starts, rough engine performance, or lost fuel economy. Seafoam is an easy way to prevent or overcome these problems. Just pour a can in your gas tank and let it clean your fuel system. You probably know someone who's used a can of Seafoam to get their truck or boat going again. People everywhere rely on Seafoam to keep their trucks, boats, and small engines running the way they should the entire season. Help your engine run better and last longer. Pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit SeafoamWorks.com to learn more.
What'd you think, Misty?
Well, I think the part where you said that it would have been hard for women not to pay attention to a man when he walks down to his knees.
I was just speculating.
I'm driving down the car listening to it alone in the car, and I'm listening, and you say that, And I say out loud in the car, that's my husband. It just said that. I laughed out loud.
Well, I was so, just, I'm just
would have, it would have been very striking to see a dude with black hair down to his
through the literature. It's all through the literature. I'm just a messenger, man. All through the literature. It said that he never gave any attention to the ladies, but the ladies gave him attention.
Oh, they did say that?
Yeah.
Dude was running through the woods on a killer spree looking like Crystal Gale.
I think he ever tripped over it.
He's too fast.
I mean, he had to have it contained somehow. For him to do what he did, he had to have it contained.
What does plaited mean? Plaited hair?
Plaited.
It's plaited. Braided. Braided. That means that's a braid.
Okay, well, he wore it braided all the time.
Ah. Clay, you didn't mention in the podcast that in our conversation, I thought was real interesting, was that he was very isolated, right? Like, I mean, you said that he wasn't interested in the ladies.
I hit on that enough?
I mean, I don't remember you talking about it at all. Maybe you did, and I missed it.
I
didn't pick up on that.
Okay. Yeah, but you're right. I didn't say it.
I mean, because to me, that was like, so if Wetzelwald walks into my office, that's one of the things that I don't think that made it to the podcast where I kind of laid out some of the things I would necessarily look for, but that would have been one that's kind of interesting to me.
Does he have the capacity to build relationships?
Yeah. Well, like what's going on there? I mean, that could be a result of the PTSD that he suffered from, or it could be other things. I mean, the fact that he was so obsessed that he took that vow so seriously to me is another thing I would want to. So if he comes into my office, I'm going to look at how he isolates and how he has relationships. I'm going to look at that obsession that he had. I'm going to look at the trauma. I'm going to look at the context.
Yeah.
So seriously, but like also the idea of a 13-year-old boy making a vow, like based on that experience, not saying it would be fun to be kidnapped by Indians.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of people who had that experience and that didn't ignite
turn into
that.
Serial killers.
It would have been interesting to be inside of their home to see how their dad, John Wetzel, just kind of who he was, because all those boys just had no conscience.
Yeah.
And, so he must have been somehow been playing. I mean,
don't think that John Wetzel was Father of the Year.
Yeah, no.
I think we can. I mean, we may be slow to diagnose, but I'm just saying.
Hey, okay, there was an interesting fact that John Wetzel dies when Louis Wetzel is 26. His dad presumably was, you know, in his 40s or 50s when he died. So Wetzel's mother remarries a guy in town. So she moves back into town.
Who's 46? The dad is 46?
I mean, Louis Wetzel, the man we're talking about, was like in his early 20s when his father was killed.
Okay.
So his mother became a widow.
Okay.
And the widow remarried.
A city slicker.
Yeah. And Louis Wetzel never liked the guy. Never forgave his mom for remarrying.
Didn't kill him, though.
No. Huh. Now, there's just so many stories that are so hard to tell. Once Louis Wetzel witnessed let me back up. Louis Wetzel only one time was noted to have killed a Native American woman. And the way that this happened is that they did a raid. They were attacked by Native Americans, bushwhacked. And I almost want to think it was when John Wetzel and George Wetzel got killed, his brother and father. Well, the other brothers go and chase down the Indians that did this and engage with them and kill the men. And they had a woman with them. And they just were like, go on your way. Like they didn't kill women. And this woman followed Wetzel and tried to basically, she wanted to be his wife. And she followed him around, and like he just kept like shooing her off, and this went on for like days.
Just what this like woman in town, or this woman that was related to
this other woman in the wilderness that Wetzel had just killed her people.
Gotcha.
And that would have been a thing inside of
that would be like a cultural,
yeah, like yeah.
Gotcha.
Like,
I see what you're
take
saying.
Me, like if my like people you. Are dead, take me.
Yeah,
gotcha. And he ended up killing that girl.
Really.
Yeah, just because she wouldn't leave him alone.
She wouldn't leave him alone.
Wild stuff.
Yeah.
Another time, Wetzel witnessed a... He was walking through the woods around an Indian camp, and he found an Indian baby laying on the ground. okay baby. I mean, a living baby. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm only telling these stories just to, it's like, we, Clay Newcomb, cannot fathom the brutality of that period and the things that he would have seen. And he, as the story went, basically, he like picks up this Indian baby, and he wasn't going to kill it. Like, he wasn't interested in killing a baby. And a squaw comes running out and says, "Ah, it's my baby. That's my baby." And so he gives the baby to the woman, and the woman proceeds to kill the baby in front of him. And then another squaw comes running out saying, "Ah, that was my baby." And this other squaw killed this other lady's baby. I mean, just brutality, nonstop brutality.
Where do these stories come from?
Man, there's a lot there. Okay, they did not have video cameras, podcasts,
what?
Photographs.
Yeah. Where's the YouTube channel?
But they did have a lot of people.
It's not a YouTube channel I'd watch.
They had a lot of people were interested in documenting stuff. Like, for instance, a fair number of the stories that we have about Lewis Wetzel came from a man named Lyman Draper, who is probably the most reliable source of the frontiersmen during that time period. Lyman Draper was like, Geraldo Rivera of
Mr.
the time,
Draper.
You know?
I don't know.
And, but Lyman Draper, if Lyman Draper said it, it doesn't mean necessarily that it's true, but it means that he recorded it true to what was told him.
Right.
And I'm not saying Draper recorded that specific instance, but some of the
stuff. A lot of the stuff is recorded by him.
Draper recorded, but just, and some of it probably is just a lie. There was another part of the podcast that I could not tell. I mean, really, the podcast could have been 2 hours long. Well, did I tell the story about the thunderstorm dream?
That does
okay.
not sound familiar.
Now, see, this is a story that you totally have to take with a grain of salt because, I mean, who knows if it happened? Lewis Wetzel's the only one. Who knows if someone made it up and told it about him? But the story's so specific, it's hard to fathom someone just making it up because it was just, I'll tell you the story. Lewis Wetzel was being pursued by Native Americans. He had done something to him, and they were after him.
Probably killed some of them.
Yeah, yeah, I can guess what it is.
So it was Tuesday.
It's Tuesday.
It got dark, and a big thunderstorm came, and he knew where there was an old abandoned cabin. And so he's like, well, I'll go stay in that abandoned cabin tonight. So he goes in the cabin, and rather than just sleeping on the floor, and this is where a backwoodsman just earns his salt, is he said, I'm not going to sleep down here in the floor. I'm going to sleep up in the rafters just in case somebody comes in. And so he needs
the salt to put in the grave.
He's asleep in the rafters.
Yeah.
And it starts thundering, and a couple hours after dark, he hears the door creak open, and here comes three or four Native Americans that are tracking him, and they had the same idea as him. It's thundering, storming, we'll go stay in that old cabin. And so Lewis Wetzel's hanging in the rafters.
It's like a horror movie.
And they come in, and they start a fire, and they start talking. And he can speak Delaware and Shawnee and multiple languages.
And so he
knew what they were saying. And he tells the story that one of them said, I had a dream last night. And he said, this Native American said that he dreamed of white-cheeked squaws with rosy red cheeks like buffalo blood and eyes as black as coal. And it was just such a random, like you can envision a guy sitting around the fire just saying, man, I had a dream about, you know, what in his culture was beauty and this and you know, longing to be home probably. And it was just so specific. And then they spend the whole night there. And then the next morning they leave. And then Wetzel goes out and ends up killing one of them.
He didn't kill him then. That's what I was expecting.
Well, he was outnumbered inside of a cabin, and he just, I guess, knew he couldn't.
How about that dude didn't sleep a wink?
Yeah, no kidding.
But do you see what I'm saying? Like, that story, there's only one place that could have come from. No one else was there with him. Wetzel told that story to someone. And how many times it came around. All I know is that I read that story
or
one time,
just makes
and I will
it up.
Always remember white-faced squaws. That's what he said. That's what white-faced squaws with cheeks as rosy red as buffalo blood. And And
eyes.
And they may not have said cold. Doggone it. Now that I'm saying it, I'm beginning to question myself. Luckily for me, I have the book right here.
I don't think many people are going to fact check you on this.
Yeah, I'm even thinking story. About how could we?
You're one of a dozen people who have purchased that book in the last 50 years.
Yeah, there is so little information about Lewis Wetzel.
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah.
That's why Steve wanted you to look it up.
That's right.
Because he's like, I'm not pouring through it.
Yeah.
While you looked that up, I thought an interesting perspective was Steve talking about how sort of the game of telephone of telling stories.
Yeah.
And I thought specifically of the turkey stories, how like I can conceive of a few guys sitting around talking about like, oh, here's the story of Lewis Wetzel. And then another guy goes, oh, that reminds me of another crazy Indian killing turkey story. Mm-hmm. And then a third guy sitting there goes, all right, two stories for Lewis Wetzel, you know, and goes, right.
Yeah.
It's just very easy for that to transmutate.
I don't know how that guy, how he left turkey tracks and didn't leave his own tracks.
I had like the same patches thought. Of snow.
Had the same thought.
I didn't describe, I said snow bank,
yeah.
But it was a patch of snow. Okay. Like
so
in the
he'd
spring.
Just walk around it and.
Well, now I've done that to my brother before turkey season.
Good I'd thing you didn't get killed.
A turkey from the year before.
In the mud. We don't have snow.
Did I say snow? I didn't mean
you
snow.
Said okay.
In the dirt, I was like, man, there was like one turkey gobbling, and I didn't want him where I was at, so I went to where he was at, where he wasn't hearing one, and I made some gobbler tracks in the road. I knew he'd find them, and he's like, man, this turkey will not gobble. I'm like, man, just hang in there. He's in there somewhere.
Okay, let me read you a little bit of something that also relates to us not knowing about Wetzel. And here's a key reason we don't know about Wetzel. The long-haired Husky Scout played on sensing no danger. He's 26 at the time, of athletic build, especially muscular in arms and shoulders. His carefully braided hair knotted around his shoulders when combed out would reach nearly to the calves of his legs. He was on the tall order, small head, black eyes, piercing in the extreme, a long, spare face, high cheekbones, a swarthy complexion, occasioned in a great measure by his exposure to the sun, and very much pitted by smallpox. So he had kind of like acne looking, you know, kind of like. And his ears bored, and he wore silk tassels in them at times and some other ornament. So he had big pierced ears too, which I didn't say
very
that on
attractive.
Says the guy with gauges in his ear.
Be hard to look away. Active on his feet, his legs were well proportioned, feet on the small order. A penetrating mind, sound judgment in regard to Indian counters, and a plan once laid, nothing could deter him from putting it into execution. Smart and active in all his movements, and a noted marksman. He could shoot and aim well, a strong constitution, and is blessed with remarkably good health. No education, not capable of keeping his own journey, which is a great pity. He could not even write his name. So he couldn't even write his name. We know a lot about Boone. We know a lot about these guys because a lot of them wrote letters to their families. Yeah. They wrote about Gerstager. What they were doing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Gerstager went and wrote a book. All these guys wrote. Davy Crockett wrote his own autobiography. You know, in not too long after this guy. So this guy just had zero education.
Yeah, he sounds like a Marvel character.
It's interesting to me how they. I think back before you had pictures and videos, people paid a lot of attention to stuff.
Yeah,
high
yeah.
cheekbones.
Complexions. I mean,
small
I can just
feet.
Imagine like yeah.
well proportioned
people talking
legs.
About Brent like that.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
What would we say about Brent?
Let's go just around the room.
Overalls.
Overalls.
Well proportioned legs, small feet.
Do we actually have to do it? Dude, one of the things in that description, though, that stuck out to me is in this idea of, like, it's difficult when you try and essentialize situations, but that is a human predilection to essentialize things. And I think that's why characters like this stick around, is because he's very easy to essentialize. Like, he has the singleness of purpose, which is, I will kill all Indians. And galvanizing personalities oftentimes have that like singleness of whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Like, I can just, this is it. Let me you know, like Tecumseh in a good way was pan-Indian unification. And so it's like very easy to tell those stories. It happens to be in Lewis Wetzel's case that it's a pretty abhorrent trait, but
yeah,
it's interesting when I look at people who have that singleness of purpose. It's really interesting to me because I don't possess that at all.
So luckily for you guys, I found the quote the thunderstorm dream. I love dreams, man. This is what he said. This is what Wetzel said that he said. "I had a dream last night," ventured one of the Indians. "I dreamed I was in the happy hunting ground, and my lodge filled with white-faced squaws, each with coal-black eyes and cheeks as red as bison's blood." "Good," grunted the other. "I, too, dreamed that a snake stung me on the heel, and it turned to a coal of fire and when I tramped it, and I had to put my foot in the flame in my sleep." "Ugh." They bound themselves closed, rocked to and fro, and then were asleep. Lewis Wetzel.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No dream, and he got killed.
Like, I had a dream I was going to have a splitting headache.
And it came true.
It is hard to wrap your mind around it.
It really is
brutality
hard.
And we don't know what that's like. We have no concept. And I think in societies like ours, that's one of the things that makes it so tough for soldiers to come home, mm-hmm. is that it's so vastly different. The lines are so blurred in a time of mm-hmm. crisis like that. And then to come home and to try to live a completely different life, it's gotta really mess with your psyche.
Yeah.
Zach, tell us about PTSD. So Zach gave me a description of PTSD on our interview, and I wasn't able to include the whole thing. Like, what would be some of the ways that you'd get that?
So PTSD would be when you go through basically a life-threatening circumstance, right? Your body, like you go through some kind of life-threatening circumstance, some kind of trauma. So, you know, it could be wartime stuff. It can be like a car accident you're in where it's very traumatic. It can be abuse as a child. And when I say life-threatening, I mean, that's like the technical kind of component to that. But it really, any kind of trauma you go through, that and basically your mind can't, it happens so fast, it's so aggressive, it's so outside of the realm of normal that your mind really can't process it, right? So the trauma just kind of gets stuck. And so you'll see, it's real common and very widely known now. So like when the military guys come back, you have a lot of flashbacks where they just feel like they're back in a wartime setting where, you know, maybe there's a loud noise outside and they, for 30 seconds, they go back to, to some kind of wartime scenario. I've had clients that have had hallucinations due to it. Especially like childhood chronic trauma, right? When I say chronic, or complex. So when I say chronic, I mean over a long period of time. So like multiple traumas over a long period of time, or complex, meaning like different types, right? So you had maybe multiple types of abuse by different people and this kind of that kind of compounded on itself. So it ruins lives. It ruins lives. And it's really those with complex trauma and chronic trauma. I mean, it is a lifelong battle that they're battling through that. You'll see, and I've seen hallucinations. You see a lot of depression, a ton of anxiety. That's why when you look at Lewis Wetzel, like the fact that he isolated himself so much, like, that very well could have been a symptom of the PTSD. Now, I can't say that for sure because it could be other things as well. Yeah. But so that would be something I would be looking at, right? It's like, I mean, you get kind of the image of the war hero who comes back and wants to go live off, you know, in a cabin in the middle of the woods and not know anybody because that trauma just gets stuck inside you.
Yeah.
And it's hard to get out. It's hard to get out.
How do you treat it?
That's what I was going to ask. Are there effective ways of?
Yeah. Lots of different opinions and thoughts on that kind of stuff. Medications oftentimes are involved to manage symptoms like the depression, the anxiety, those kind of things. If somebody comes into my office and they've got some trauma. So what I'm going to look at is, first you want to assess it, right? Are we dealing with super complex, pretty simple trauma? What are we looking at? And then from there, I want to assess their capacity to kind of, because we really have to, you've got to process it and you've got to get it out, right? Like you have to find a way to, I will use journaling a lot with people. We'll go back through and journal.
Good luck doing that with Lewis Wetzel.
Lewis Wetzel, he couldn't read. We'd have to talk it out with him. So, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at the pace we have to go at, and you want to get it. So we're going to go back and reprocess it. Oftentimes you have to be really careful with that because you can re-traumatize people. You'll hear that all the time that, you know, my wife tells me I need to talk about it. I was like, well, maybe you do, maybe you don't. Let's figure this out first. Or maybe we need to go to at a slower pace than what you might go. I'm probably giving you too much of an answer than you want.
No, that's
you can
good.
Cut I'm it intrigued. All out. You can cut it all out. But basically, you're going to go back and reprocess it slowly and at an effective pace. You're going to teach them to handle it. That trauma also defines you, right? So, like, it tells you things. So, it tells you, like, so with Lewis Wetzel, you would go back and be like, hey, your dad lied to you. Indian, you know, Native Americans aren't all bad, right? And so it's because that habit has been just ingrained inside of his mind.
You have to go back and fix it right where it got broke.
Yep. So you can go back and fix the trauma, but you've still got all the bad habits. You still got all the behavioral things that you've dealt with over the years. And so you have to process through the trauma. There's different ways of doing that. Then you've got to deal with the poor definers and bad habits and all the things that they've built up over the years. And then you got to point them forward. There has to be forward movement. So you can never just stay too much in the past. You never want to dwell on the past. You want to deal with it and move on.
Yeah.
And so you want to, you know, if you had Wetzel in the office, you deal with the trauma, you help him think differently about all the things that trauma created inside of him. Who knows what it created inside of him?
Have you ever actually thought about literally sitting with Lewis Wetzel, like the Lewis Wetzel in front of you, and what you would do? What would you say to him?
I mean, I do it every day, Clay.
No, but I mean, think about the actual, I mean, a guy that literally had done this and was this hardened and was this, like.
Yeah. I mean, I've dealt with people that have done things like that before. I mean, you just talk to them like a human being, you know. You bring them in their office and you talk to them.
What have you seen, brother?
What have you, I mean, you just talk to them. I mean, you just talk to them just like a human. They're a human. At the core, they're a human being, right? They've been through a lot of crap. And I've never met.
That's really stiff language for the Bergeries podcast.
I've never met a human being that didn't want to get better. You know?
Really?
And on,
you think Lewis Wetzel would have wanted to have gotten better?
Well, there might be a selection factor here. People are walking into Zach's office.
Yeah. So that's part of it. But I mean, he might not have wanted to stop killing Native Americans.
Do you think he felt?
But he wanted to stop the pain that he was in. He was not a healthy human being.
Yeah, okay. That's so an interesting distinction.
You think he would have recognized that?
Well, I mean, he would have known he's in pain. He would not know that there's something we could do about it. And he might, and to him.
So the killing was a symptom of the pain.
Well, I mean, that's.
A bad habit is what Zach's describing. Yeah,
I would say
the
more.
Trauma-induced
so
habit.
Trauma-induced behavior.
Like the lightest possible way to ever.
So I mean, he was just this happy, happy guy.
He lives by himself. He doesn't have any friends.
He's
totally isolated.
Messed up.
I mean, he's a messed up dude.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a messed up.
I'm not arguing with you. I'm just trying to say what can we infer?
Now that's assuming that, you know, we're making a ton of assumptions, but that would be my first go-to, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he's in pain and he does it. And sometimes you get so used to the pain, you don't even know it's there. Right.
Yeah.
And so like,
he wouldn't know anything but a war zone.
It's so much part of who he is that he probably can't separate it, would be my guess.
Yeah.
Right. And so if somebody like that comes in and wants to work, yeah, absolutely. You could do some stuff with that. Now, the challenge is, would he want to work? All those kind of things.
Yeah.
So those would be my musings on it.
Did you guys hear at the end of the podcast that they exhumed his grave in 1948?
Or not, 42.
Yeah, I think 42. That's part of what's kind of crazy to me is that in recent history, people are treating him like he's a hero.
Yeah.
I think that was the, listening to it, that was, okay, so you could say this is a different time and murder was much more common, killing is a war zone. You could say all that, but it's like 1942, people exhumed his grave to treat him like a hero?
I mean, there are people alive today that were alive in 1942.
I know, that's what I'm saying. That's
exactly.
That's wild.
It is wild.
Yeah and I was completely guessing. I wasn't able to go back to, like, I couldn't find, you know, like who decided to drive to Mississippi and get the whatever kind of red tape they had in 1942. Maybe it wasn't much to exhume the grave of Louis Wetzel, carry him back to McCreary County, West Virginia, and rebury him. And, you know, they don't even know for sure that it was him that they actually brought back, but they said it was.
Didn't they say
it long hair?
Well, they did. But it's also, it's not like that's in some government document or something, that it's just tradition.
Might have been Larry Wetzel, and they got the wrong grade.
Oh, no.
Who also happened to have Crystal Gale's length hair.
Yeah.
Does the hair last for
That's
what I thought too. Yeah.
I'm just saying,
especially in probably the kind of casket.
It's a self-serving, like, the guy who dug him up and moved him all the way to West Virginia and buried him gave the account. So it's like kind of self-interest.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to be like, I have no idea if it was the guy.
You know, all these stories may be made up. Louis Wetzel might have been the nicest guy in the world.
He might not have even existed.
Never even hurt anybody.
It's a prank by his brother. His brother just shared all these stories about him.
Well, that's what is so hard about telling any of these stories. So when I was doing the stories on just in all the stories that I tell, you often interview multiple people to tell one story.
Right.
And even Dad and I, you know, Dad since mid-70s, and now I'm, you know, 40 something, and we tell stories different now that happened to us at the same time in the same place.
Like the two of you tell different versions,
like he says,
of the same story.
He says, no, it didn't happen like that. And I'm like, it happened like that, Dad. That's the way it happened.
Who's
and
right?
He's like, no. Well, I mean, it has me questioning myself.
Well,
what I always say.
Yep.
And just how quickly, and then this is hundreds of years ago, and it's come down through so many people who've polished the story. I mean, and kind of maybe just told it a little different, or told it easier, or told it with a little different emphasis or a little different narrative. And that's why I like, it's really fun when you find a really hardcore story that is just vetted from so many different places. And that's why Daniel Boone is such a cool guy, because his life was incredibly well documented for the time period.
Yeah.
Like, unbelievably well documented, which was unusual. So that's part of what makes Boone who he was, is we just simply knew who he was. We had all these different things, which, like guys like Wetzel, we don't. Brent, why don't you finish this out reading The Ballad of Louis Wetzel? So this is a poem by Philip somebody.
The Life and Times of Louis Wetzel. This is a poem entitled The Ballad of Louis Wetzel by Glenn Baker. My parents came from sturdy stock. They were tall, brown, and people and merry, with the keen eyesight of the soaring hawk and lips like the red haw berry. Horny-handed folk, injured to toil, they marched in the pioneer. Now, that's what that says. And I could not read it fast enough, but that's what it said.
Carry on. It means calloused hands.
Callous-handed folk, inured to toil, they marched in the Pioneer Legion to carve a home from the virgin soil of Virginia's farthermost region. And I was born on the wilderness road in a tawny, sunlit clearing. I cut my teeth on oxen goad and had a backwoods rearing. And I remember the cabin there in the clearing on the big wheeling, the coarse but wholesome pioneer fare, and the herbs that hung from the ceiling. I keep waiting for this, and Merry Christmas to all and all a good night. And childhood years when days were long and the first spring winds were blowing, my mother humming an old Welsh song and my father bent to his hoeing. And then one day the Indians came, and with their inhuman yells and laughter, and our cabin blazed with rifle flame, and smoke went to the rafters. But the walls were staunch, and the red men fled, and the days flowed on as before, till I grew too tall for a trundle bed, and I slept on the puncheon floor. And so I came to my tall manhood with a woodman's knowledge and daring, and so with a rifle for livelihood, I started my forest faring. And once I was turned the homeward way across the trail of some savages and hurried on through the dying day, sensing a scene of red savages. And when I came to the clearing there, when the path of maize was greening, I saw my mother tearing her hair and walking the woods with her keening. And my father's form so still and cold, with the riven skull that was hairless, and all that remained of a loved household shattered by red hands and careless. And over the grave we dug that night in the raw, rich frontier clay, I swore an oath to harry and blight the red race by night and day. I swore it there as the forest gloomed, forbidding and dark in its silence, a savage oath that forever doomed us all to a life of violence. And many a red brave homeward bound from the latest scene of his pillage heard in the forest a moaning sound and died within sight of his village. And there's more. For thus I played on the red man's fear as I blew through my rifle bore, warning him with his end was near with the death wind of border lore. And down the years I kept my vow till the red tribes westward turning left this valley to settler and plow in freedom from pillage and burning. And time rolled on and my breath was stilled and they laid me away to the long rest. But even in death my spirit willed to continue on with the long quest. So still I follow the trail of braves and wraith-like still I go stealing over the hands the Ohio laves in the Cincinnati to the big wheeling. And on autumn nights when the dark winds carol and thunderstorms roll and rally, you can hear me blow through my rifle barrel the length of the Ohio Valley.
Mm.
Thus say Lewis Wetzel.
Pretty dark. What do you think, Misty?
It's just weird to hear something that dark rhymed.
Now, when was that written?
I don't know. I couldn't find when it was written.
I'm sorry, but it feels like a Christmas story that you would read to your kids, yeah. Especially with Brent's voice on it.
I can't wait for that.
And it's like, this is really the worst thing I've ever. It's horrible.
I and my sash. But
it just described the time. I mean that's the whole point. I think of this is to me, or just kind of like the takeaway is just like it was a war zone. And it's interesting to feel like that could be normal to just have in your sights a race of people to just annihilate. But and he told why they were mad at him. I mean, they burned mm-hmm. his cabin and they killed his dad.
I mean, you think about it, it really is a singular perspective because
right.
you think about it from the perspective of a Native American.
Exactly.
People and, you know, coming in and killing people and taking your things, of course you're going to retaliate,
yeah.
you know? So it's it's hard when the perspectives are so spread apart and there's a no opportunity for really,
mm-hmm.
Humans mess things up. I mean, yeah. that's one thing you can look at the earth and realize that humans mess things up.
Yeah.
And,
you know, but the redemption is that, all it takes for things to get right is for people to start making one right decision after another.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the golden ticket that we have as humans is we get to decide how we forecast our life in terms of the way that we think about other people. And you know, these kind of stories too give me empathy for people that I know live in a completely different philosophical place or have a different worldview because you can see, I mean, I don't want to, we know which side was really in the wrong in the macro picture. I mean, just the side that was committing genocide and pushing right. the people out of their ancestral lands. Like that's not up for debate. But at the same time, you see why these people loved Lewis Wetzel. It's like they were in a war zone and their enemy, he protected them from them. But you go to the other side, and you see the Native Americans' perspective of, you know, these people came in and were taking our land and we had no choice and we had to fight. And basically you just see that your perspective is not the only one.
Lewis Wetzel was taking one thing off of the list that was out to hurt those folks. You know, they were. It was a big enough struggle just finding something to eat,
mm-hmm.
raise your kids, you know, up to where they would live, where they could help, that they had to look up to that guy, or they, you see the reason why they did.
Yeah.
Because he was taking one fear away from them, you know, something that they could check the box off and say, okay, we don't have to worry about that today because Lewis is making the rounds out there. We can focus on trying to get this corn to grow, which was something mentioned about corn in that poem I just read. So, I mean, you see it, Debbie. It doesn't make it right, but you see where those folks, they were in that space at that time, and that was something that they had to worry about, and he was alleviating some of that pain.
You know, listening to Brenton talk, it makes me think about, you know, our society these days is so polarized, and the older I get, the more I recognize that the answer is not found in the extremes.
Yeah.
Right.
You know what I mean? The answer is found in the principle of things. Lewis Wetzel was extreme. He saw this thing that he perceived as a threat, as a something that needed to be annihilated, and he went hardcore extreme. And then you have, I'm sure you had people on the Native American side that said, like, let's wipe all these white men out because they're destroying our lands. And the answer is not found in the extremes.
Yep. Well, thanks for coming, Zach.
Yeah, it was fun.
Appreciate it.
Thanks
for having
me.
So will you be giving us written diagnoses of all our problems?
Will you diagnose Brent real quick?
You guys will all be getting a bill in the mail, first of all. Pay that promptly.
Yep.
And the diagnosis will be coming shortly.
What do you think about Isaac's tattoos? What's that tell you about a man? Isaac Neal's covered in tattoos.
I'm just insecure.
I'm just noticing.
Or really secure with his legs.
He does like show a lot of leg. I'm going to say the lack of color. Is what I would ask him.
He's
about.
He's monochromatic.
What do you mean?
I don't have any color tattoos.
No color
black
tattoos.
Ink.
They're all black ink.
Yeah, that's cool.
I want you
I'm
to ask
saying
him
cool
about.
Or not cool. I'm just asking him about it.
I think the most fascinating part of Isaac's tattoos is how much forethought he put into them.
Okay.
Some of them a lot.
Some of them none.
I like them. Less, some of them, yeah. None.
I saw that in a book and thought it looked cool.
Are you going to get a tattoo of me on your somewhere?
Are you funding it?
Sure. Yes.
I'll get to pick the spot.
Don't do this, Isaac. This is bad.
Look, you could put that picture of me shooting that bear.
Oh.
See that picture in that nice picture?
Yeah. No, I like the one with your kid on your back.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I don't want you to put my kid tattooed on.
That'd be creepy.
I'll blur out the face.
You could put those little stickers. Those little
pixelated face tattoo. I like it.
It would be cool to have a Brent tattoo, though.
Who doesn't have one?
I want a life-size
you need a Brent
tattoo
sticker.
Of Brent, only
face,
bigger.
Smile. Yeah.
We're working on it.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Well, all right. Excellent, guys. Well, next Bear Greases are going to be different than this one.
Hopefully so a little more.
The Death Wind. We're pulling ourselves out of the arc of darkness.
Oh, good.
I thought it was really poetic how you said that at the end, by the way. Yeah, there were a couple points in this podcast that I had thoughts about, but.
What did I say?
Yeah, you just talked about coming out of the arc of darkness. And it,
Mr. Rogers.
Yeah.
Mr. Rogers.
I'm looking forward to that podcast.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the Mr. Rogers podcast.
Thanks, guys. Keep the wild places wild.
After 3 years of work, our follow-up to the Meat Eater Fish and Game Cookbook is here. It's the Meat Eater Outdoor Cookbook, wild game recipes for the grill, smoker, campfire, and camp stove. Here is your book for everything that's best cooked or eaten outside, from grilling to open fire cooking to Dutch ovens to smokers to barbecue to backpacking meals to how to pull off the perfect fish fry. With pit stops along the way for lessons about ice age cooking methods and the best 5 ways to construct a cooking fire you can be proud of. And of course, we're focusing on wild game and fish here with over 100 recipes, including stuffed venison burgers 3 ways, wild duck with aji verde sauce, a jerky made with cola, a gin and tonic made with fire charred lemons, and grilled frog legs made with a sticky sweet sauce. This ain't your normal cookbook, so be prepared to be surprised. Get your copy now. For more info, visit themeateater.com or buy it wherever books are sold.